Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. And today, we are going to be taking a journey back into history. History of the United States, one of the most tragic episodes that ever occurred in this country, to my best knowledge. And it's one that is well recorded. And my guest today, George Stein, has put together this phenomenal publication, Sing Before Breakfast, A Story of Gettysburg. Now, for those of you that I'm sure are familiar with history, I'm sure you're aware of the fact that well over 600,000 people died in this war. It is a war on our soil that, my goodness, will always have controversial conversation about it, but it was just horrific. And we're going to be talking about this aspect of history with a man who, before we went on air, was saying, Donna, I waited too long to write this book. I want to welcome to the airwaves George Stein. George, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me, Donna.
George, I was so impressed with this publication. I could barely put this book down. It was something that I felt I was living the experience of a young man, and the anguish, the vividness of detail. I have to ask you, George, what is it about Gettysburg that grabbed your attention? Were you born and raised in Virginia? Was this something that was part of training and history when you were growing up? Why is it you were so fascinated with Gettysburg?
Well, some of all of that. I was raised about 100 miles from Gettysburg and didn't really know other than being a name and what it was supposed to be about until I was a young man in 1959 and went there for the first time. Took the family and other people with me, and we took a government tour of it, and it was a mind-blowing experience in that it came alive to me. And at the very end, at the site of what's called Pickett's Charge, I felt that I had been there. And it was so overwhelming that I sat down on the running board of the car and cried.
Oh, and, my heavens.
Yes, and it was so powerful. A tragedy in my mind that it took me years before I went back. I had to recover from it. At any rate, I did, and then I became enamored of Gettysburg. It's a beautiful place, and it's not very big, really, when you consider what happened there, but it's a place that gets inside of you, and you walk with the feeling you're walking on hallowed ground, and yet the people, the Park Service, permits you to go almost anywhere you want to. There are people who live there in houses that were there at the time. And you have to respect that. But there's one place where there's a big flat rock near the George Weichert house where those of us who like to go to their house, they have a big picnic and clean it up afterwards, of course. But it's a wonderful place to go. And I read everything I could find on it. Well, that's not quite true, but I read everything I was had the capacity to read. And this story began to come out. The characters began to emerge, both real ones and fictional ones. And so I began to put them down on paper and went from there.
I love the artwork in this book. Who is the person that did the pen and ink drawings? They captured the essence of your story and this young young boy that you write about, actually, he's a young adult. He's not a little boy. He's a young adult. And of course, the story talks about his transformation. And I just am so impressed with his artwork. It is spectacular.
Well, the illustrations were done by my son, Doug. He's an artist. And I think he did a great job. And it makes the book more than it would be, certainly without them.
Well, I'll tell you what, he captured the very emotion and essence and feel of that part of the country. It's just, he's just an incredibly fine artist. Now, I want to quote some of the information that you have here, because you talk about late June of 1863, and I'm quoting directly from your book, the armies of both the North and South converged on Gettysburg with 170,000 men and 80,000 animals. In 20 hours of combat spread over the first 3 days of July 1863, almost a third of those engaged lay dead, wounded, or were missing or captured. Besides the enormous task of disposing of the 7,000 bodies dead on the field, another 4,000 of the 21,000 wounded would later die, and 5,000 dead horses were left to rot in the July sun for the citizens of Gettysburg to deal with. And it just, I think of the movie Gone with the Wind, and there's that one scene where they have the portrayal of all of these men that are laid out.
I remember that.
Like sticks of wood on dirt because they had no place else to put it. That scene has never left my mind, and what you have just described is horrific, and it was on American soil. It was Americans fighting Americans. And oh my goodness, that is tremendously emotional just to think of that alone.
Well, you know, there were wounded laid out in the bend of Rocky Creek, it's called, and the floods, rains came so heavy that they had a flash flood, and all the wounded were suddenly in danger of drowning, and they had to rush in and drag them kicking and screaming up on the bank, wounded or not, and still several hundred of them were drowned. The rains came and washed everything down in the streams and valley and wells, and ruined the water supply, all this putridity and waste material and but decaying bodies, and the people of Gettysburg almost died of thirst for a while.
Mm-hmm, because they couldn't drink the water, because it was contaminated with the...
All contaminated.
Yeah, just with the waste material, the blood and flesh of those that were wounded.
I would add this. When I go there, and I've been there 30 or 40 times, and I've been there with a variety of people I've taken, I never fail to go somewhere on that battlefield that it doesn't overwhelm me. And even now as I speak and remember some of the things that happened there, I'm emotionally involved. It was such a terrible thing.
Sometimes I think, and as you said so well just a moment ago, you felt like you had been there, that you had lived through it. And I think that sometimes those experiences, when they're that real, you never, ever ignore them. And I think that is the value of this book, Sing Before Breakfast, A Story of Gettysburg. The story that you have here, you say you didn't see the need to fiddle around with the truth with anything that you put in this book.
That's
and
right.
You said, so much remains fresh and clear to me as if it happened yesterday. And I really want to quote this one paragraph here. You say, no matter how wise in the ways of war and how high a rank a man attains, in most cases, he can only see what's going on for maybe 50 yards. Most actions are obscured by terrain or smoke or trees or brush, or may be out of range of vision and out of control, or beyond comprehension altogether. When once a battle gets going, it quickly develops into a savage, indescribable, free for all, and no one person ever sees or knows it all. My goodness, how many times have we heard about history is portrayed by those that want said what they want said, and it's all perception. We are only able sometimes just to look at a little tiny postage stamp section of it. If we're involved in it, that's what we see.
Yes, how true. Well said.
Now, you have a poem in here. I'm a handsome soldier boy. Now, don't you think I'm grand? I wear a pretty uniform and strut to beat the band. I march along to drum and fife as off we go to war. I'd never trade the army life for what I had before. Whoever wrote those words, I think, had tongue in cheek, because any soldier.
That whole book is allegorical.
Mm-hmm.
It tries to depict the innocence of the country before the Civil War, the horror of the war, and the change that occurred to the country as a result of the Civil War. And that one verse that you wrote, read, and all of my composed, by the way, are showing that when they first marched off the war, they were playing bands and they got uniforms and everybody was sure they were going to win and all like that. They did not know until they saw their friends' heads rolling down the field and their ankles flung in the trees and their arms sailing through the wind, through the air, how terrible it would be. And that's true of all combat.
Absolutely. Your book starts out with a story of a family. And the narrative is spoken by the young man that this book is all about, and his life, and how his life was changed within literally minutes. And I found that when I was reading this, I could smell grandma's cooking in the kitchen. I could hear the clucking of the chickens, and when I was going through it, this is something that anybody, when they start reading this, would say, this was an idyllic life. These people were living what, in those times, would have been considered the best of the best as far as life goes.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it that way. I heard the chickens also, and I heard Granny and smelled her potato soup being made and all those things. It's part of my own history. And I just say I'm 82 years old, but I remember back when I was 9 visiting a farm for a while that had no electricity, no running water, no anything we have today. And I remember well how it was to live there. And we've come a long way since then, but at least in my lifetime, I touched it. And I heard tales from the old soldiers.
Mm-hmm. How many old soldiers were you able to interview?
I never interviewed anybody from the Civil War, but when I was a boy of 5, there was a man across the street, had a little grocery store, it was black with age, named Mr. Grubb. Mr. Grubb was in his 90s, and they said he had been a veteran of the Civil War. He never told any tales. He was very taciturn. But somewhere it happened that the link was made to oral history. You know, if a man of 90 told a boy of 10, he would only have to be told the third time to talk about George Washington's last address, having been present. So oral histories, my mother told me most of what I know. She was a wonderful, intelligent, history-loving person. And she was born on the 40th anniversary of the First Battle of Bull Run. And she was always a dyed-in-the-wool Yankee. But she gave me an interest in the Civil War and a patriotism for it, because if you read my book, you'll notice that I give credit for both sides for what they did right and what they did wrong.
Yes.
It's tragic any way you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand the South point of view The South had against it that 4 million people were in slavery. And that had to go one way or another. But other than that, I've known many, many people throughout the South that are wonderful, wonderful people. And we're in just a generation or two away, we'd have been trying to kill each other.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's one of the poignant parts of your material that I think is so significant. The human race does not seem to want to learn the lessons from the past. And it's like, here we go again. And when I read your book, I thought if more people could really read this kind of material and have the perspective of overview, maybe war would be the last thing that would be considered, but I don't know that it'll ever go out of the human experience. Maybe I'm making a pessimistic statement, but just knowing the nature of human beings, they'd have to grow up a lot to be able to get past this. Now, Reese is...
have to evolve into something else besides human beings.
Well, that may be too. Just don't know. But this is what we're contending with today. Now, the young man's name, and correct me if I'm saying it wrong, is Reese?
Rice. It's German. It's a German name for Rice. My great-grandmother, maternal grandmother's maiden name was Rice, R-E-I-S. And his name is a combination of both my great-grandfather and my great-grandmother. And that's why in the book someplace the kids tease him about his name being Rice. And they say that them Chinamen eat rice. You know, that's in there, and they tease him at school.
Mm-hmm.
He frequently had it misspelled as R-I-C-E. And, but that is Rice, long E-I in German.
Now, Reese is a young man, and he comes from a wonderful, wonderful family. Each of the family members have their own persona, but Granny especially I related to because she had such a strong personality and no-nonsense kind of person. But you make a statement in the book that these people considered the land and the abundance that was given by the land their livelihood, and it had to be taken care of because their well-being depended on the land being maintained well. And you stated that the elders demonstrated respect and reverence for all of it. And this is something that I think we're coming back into more and more.
Yeah.
And this is very good. The fishing that you talk about, and someone listening to this will say, gee whiz, what does this have to do with the Civil War? Well, this is all part of the environment that people were living in, that within just a very short period of time, as soon as the cavalry came in, and most of these people, because they didn't have cell phones, they didn't have the telegraph in their houses where they could hear a Morse code warning that someone was going to be invading their property. They might get a neighbor riding in on a horse saying, beware, something's going on and you may be next. They were so isolated in a way. And you bring that out, and that's where Reese, getting up on his beautiful, beautiful horse that you describe here, this beautiful farm horse, and taking a ride, he's all of a sudden in the midst, I'd say in the midst of hell. That is how...
All of a sudden what?
He was just in the midst of hell. That's how I would say it. Because he's in an environment that he maybe fantasized about a little bit, but never did he realize what he was going to see.
Well, like I said, it's an allegory in that it tries to show how quickly this country changed from the innocent, you call it, farm country and separate states and all. You know, Virginia had been in business for 230 or 240 years before the Civil War. Our first three presidents were Virginians, and they had all, everything worked out, and along came the Civil War and changed everything for them. But the allegory suggests that almost overnight, the United States went from being a farmland to a world power. The United States Army, at the end of the Civil War, could have bought anybody on earth. The fact that they didn't set a precedent for all future, that the United States is not a territorial country, I mean, other than its what? Its continental territory. They never fought Europe or Asia to gain land. But some people would take exception to that, but I don't. And so the Civil War was a remarkable thing. I mean, the Civil War only lasted 4 years. And it cost an incredible amount of, I think, $5 billion, which is an unheard of amount, unimaginable amount. And but the United States suddenly found itself in a position of world power, and we're still stuck with that. And thank God for that, in a way that our Virginians that set the establishment of the rules and laws of this country were the ones that set the course for the rest of it. If that makes sense.
Well, you describe how Reese gets involved in the battle, and he's having conversations with his friends, and there's this wonderful illustration of country boys sitting up on a wood fence talking about how they can watch the war from the fence, and they recognize certain generals and they're pointing them out, but once the war, the battle begins, they can't see anything. There is so much smoke and smell and the screams of the dying, all of this, it transforms their world literally in minutes.
Yep. Yes, it does. And they didn't have even the sound was so intense, they couldn't even hear the commands of the bugle. That's why their flags were so important. When they said rally around the flag, it meant, here we are, boys. Here we are.
Mm-hmm.
They could find their units instead of wandering around in a fog. Times have changed, but in many ways they haven't. Character is still character.
This is a book that when you are reading it, there are times that the emotion of what you are conveying and portraying in your writing just grips one. And you can feel all of these different persons that you wrote about. Now, in the back of your book, you talk about biographical sketches of individuals that you mention in this book. And historically, you're giving out a lot of historical information. But when you think of the times and the people and what their belief systems were, the art of war was something that many of them had been trained for, and a lot of them had not been trained for.
That's true.
And this is partially what you bring out in this book. And it is something that allows a view of human character and how good, bad, or indifferent, you have all factors present on the battlefield and having to deal with it. And the positioning that Reese had, I mean, to have an officer, a commanding officer, turn around and tell you, and again, in minutes, his life is transformed. This is what I need you to do. I need you to run messages for me. And, oh my goodness, first he thinks, that's terrific. And then it's like, oh my goodness. He grows up within minutes. He becomes an adult in his thinking in many ways in a very short period of time.
Yes. And that's the way it happens on the battlefield. Other young men have had that same experience. The Audie Murphys, and these young men that are 20 years old and get the Congressional Medal of Honor, they became soldiers in a very short order.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I had a conversation with someone not too long ago, and we were talking about photographs of people that would have been made.
About
and
what?
About photographs of people that, let's say, were in the First World War and even in the Second World War. And we both made the observation how old these people looked. And if you take pictures of people today, you don't have that same thing. A 17-year-old today that you might take a picture of and you compare it with one that was taken at that time, they were very old. And it's the same thing when you look at the photographs of the people during that time. They were relatively young, many of them, but were very, very old. You look at the faces of the quote-unquote children, and they didn't have what I call youthful faces. Maybe it was just the demeanor that they were portraying, but I don't think so. It's like they were very, very old souls.
I once did a study of the age of the generals at Gettysburg, both North and South, and I think the average age was 41 and a half years. That's the average age, including Robert E. Lee, who was 56. So many of the, there was a couple young generals, like General Alexander Webb was only 28.
Mm-mm. That is very, very young. Very, very young. Again, I have to compliment your son's art. He has a portrayal of a family that is in a building that was of brick to protect the family so that they would not be killed. And they're hidden in this building on their property. And it is a very frightening experience when they're found and what they have to deal with. Cemetery Hill is listed in your book. These portrayals, these stories that are about people that managed to survive the war, the feeling of terror and helplessness is so paramount. It's the same thing that people go through today with the stories of war that we're listening to right now on media. Every single day, we are watching films of people being bombed and looking. They just don't have any safe shelter. They have no safe havens.
Yes. I'd like to say a comment about Doug's art. See, those pictures are from either poses or from actual photographs that he did. And like the basement picture of the family, I can't think of their name right now, but anyway, the people in the basement, he actually went in a basement and got those drawings of the stones and everything. He'd go to Gettysburg on the day of anniversary day, at the time of day when the sun was just right, to do a photograph that he could later on do a drawing from. I said, "Doug, nobody will know that." He said, "I will. His drawings are so accurate. And the shadows are exactly right and everything." And then, you know, I have to put a 2 cents in for him.
Well, they're beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful. You have in here a comment that in your research, you learned that over 1,000 generals served both sides during the Civil War.
Yep.
And that amount of generals, obviously a lot of them didn't survive, but that is a huge number.
It isn't it?
Just a huge number. Now, George, we're going to take a break for just a moment, and I want to continue with a little bit more history. And we'll be talking about Stonewall Jackson. So we'll be back in just a moment. For those of you that are authors that would like to submit material to me to be able to have an interview on air, send your your finished publication to the Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Lakewood, Washington 98497. Be sure to include your contact information. Again, send it to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Lakewood, Washington, and allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. George, I wanted to start off again with a very well-known person in American history. Some people love him, some people hate him. Stonewall Jackson. And you, yes, you say that he used a local boy, just like Reese as being portrayed, to guide him through the woods and back roads on his flank march on the Union Army at Chancellorsville. And young kids were used for this because they could move fast. They'd run. They would just, they just go like crazy.
Yes, and they knew the territory.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone that Stonewall Jackson route at Chancellorsville, and it's actually, it's not quite at Chancellorsville. Chancellorsville was a building. It wasn't a, people think it was a city. It wasn't. At any rate, it's 12 miles through the wilderness that he marched those troops throughout the Yankees. Stonewall Jackson, in my view, is one of the most misunderstood figures of the Civil War. He brought a lot of that on himself, but he wasn't all as bad as they make him out to be. Do we have a minute for a short Stonewall Jackson anecdote?
Sure, go right ahead.
When he was a major teaching at the Virginia Military Institute, he organized a school for young black children to read. And the citizens of the town came to him and said, "Major, you can't do this. This is against the law, and we must protest. You can't teach black children to read." And he said, "I do it so they can read the Bible." He said, "They're God's children too, you know." That's a side of him that many people don't see. But anyway, the war happened right after that. He went off to the Shenandoah Valley, and at the time of this incident was stationed at Winchester. And everybody was dying to know what was going on. There was, as you said, no communication much. And one day, a letter arrived at the office of the president of VMI with the return address of T.J. Jackson, Winchester, Virginia. And the president of the college said, "Now we'll know what's going on. Now we'll get the real story." He opened the envelope, and it was a check for $7 from Stonewall in the payment of the, his care of his children's school that he had forgot to leave. Can you imagine being up to your rear in war and remembering to send a $7 check for the black children?
Amazing. What a story. I don't think I've ever heard anything like that said about Stonewall Jackson.
James R. Robinson wrote a book called Stonewall. Wonderful book. It's in there.
You also give a point of information about an officer's sword. And again, all of these details that you have put into this book, to me, were so interesting. And one of the things, because we always see the pictures of the men carrying these swords, and you make the comment that infantry soldiers rarely sharpened their swords. They used more, and I'm quoting from your book, on the backs of shirkers than they did as weapons, and the sword was more of a symbol of command. I thought all of the soldiers had swords.
No, no, only the officers and the cavalry. The sword of the officer was his symbol of command, his symbol of authority. That's why when they surrendered, the first thing they did was to hand over their sword. That was handing over their scepter. Authority. The cavalry used the great sabers, and they used them as weapons. But the officers, normally, their swords were not that sharpened, or they were not sharpened. They were just, again, they were like a stanchion, you know, to hold it up. And they did it. They did whack people on the rear end with it to get them moving, but they were not weapons in the normal sense. The ordinary enlisted man never had swords unless he was in the cavalry.
Interesting. Now, Sally is the horse, and Sally is a farm horse like a Clydesdale, and she's just a fabulous animal, and this is what Reese is riding on, and he talks about the drummer boys and how they were around his age, but many of them were a lot younger. And many of them died in the war. And you don't hear too much said about that. And then there is the real conversation about what goes on between the generals. And there's a quote that you have in here, or actually it's a poem, and I'm going to read it. They saw a cloud of birds so vast they took it as a warning, foreboding that their lives would pass before another morning. The apprehension of so many of these soldiers, desertion, was something that was very common. When they realized the horrors of the war that they were involved with, many of these men ran away.
Oh, yeah, there were many desertions. But not as many as you might think. A lot of them deserted to go home and send their family. There were very few cowards.
And that is something people don't realize, that these men, when they were gone from their farms, when you think the major portion, a good 97% of the population, were tenders of the land. They were farmers. They had, this is how they had to live. And if their wife was left at home and had three or four children, which was not unusual, then how is she going to manage the children and taking care of the crops and all of the other things?
You know that armies used up the wood and the trees around them for a lot of things, for fire, for clearing the land for artillery, for making breastworks and all that. But one thing that people never realized was that, like for Harper's Ferry, which was Virginia at the time, for a radius of 20 miles, there were no trees at all. They were all gone. And the trees in Virginia disappeared. If you look at some of the old photographs of Virginia, they're without trees. And that was what was used to make fencing. And so without the fencing, and if the fences burned up for fuel and all, there was no way to keep the animals out of the crops.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was an extreme hardship, particularly for the wives.
You make a statement in your book that I think applies to every soldier that has ever been. And I'm going to quote this again from your book. A soldier must abide. He must learn to live outside the dreadful things before him, or he would go mad in his first mile. And I think that any person, male or female, that has ever served as a soldier, no matter what culture they're in, would probably say those words are so true that the average civilian just has no concept of them.
Yes, I think so. I think they are true.
And then you make a comment, and this is from Reese. How can I reconcile the terrible deeds of this battlefield with what is in the good book and all I have been taught about what is proper and decent and fair? You know, I talked with someone, and I've heard this from more than one soldier, that they were raised, you do not kill, you have the Ten Commandments, basically. Again, this happens in various cultures around the world. And then you sign up for the military, you're taught how to kill, and then you're given the order to go out and kill the enemy. And more than one man has said to me, and woman, that that was something that they had a difficulty with, and it stayed with them their entire life. It really caused them a lot of distress and anxiety. And I thought, this has been so true with so many soldiers. And with the Civil War, that went on for a long, long time. And in the minds of many people, it still is, just like with you, just very much alive and very, very real. It's not dead.
Yes. The tragedy is that many of those soldiers from both sides made friends after the war. I know a man who's dead now, but he was the son of the Hap Arnold, who was head of the Air Force in World War II. He and his wife vacationed for 11 years with General Adolf Galland, who was head of the fighter squadron, the Nazi fighter squadron. They became dear friends. And you know, the tragedy is not only what is done, but what is lost.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at the reunion of the Gettysburg men, you'll see the men in gray and the men in blue shaking hands and hugging one another without exception. They lived through something that was terrible, something was indescribable, and they all know it, and they all know that they'll never be able to share it completely except with one another.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes.
War is so terrible.
And that is the way it is with even the soldiers of today.
Yes, absolutely.
It's very rare that soldiers will talk to a civilian openly.
The reason is they can't. You can't tell them. I've thought about that. I was in the Marines, and I never saw combat, but we all thought we were going to.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anybody was ever able to tell us, even the veterans that we were with, what it was really like. And knowing you can't do it, why try? You have to find out for yourself.
Now, in your book, in the section where you are giving information about different people, most of the individuals that you talk about, or you have back here in the back of your book, are men. But you have a Matilda Tilly Pierce.
Yes.
She was born on March 11th, 1848. She was 15 years old when the Battle of Gettysburg went on. And
yep.
She actually lived in Gettysburg. And she wrote a book about this. This is quite a woman.
Wonderful book. I've read it, of course, but it's well done and very articulate. That's where I got my information for Chapter 6 from our book.
George, we're almost out of time, and I want to read a quote out of your book. An awful game is war, not just the blood and gore, when orphans weep and widows keep a vigil at the door. A soldier falls in pain to never rise again. To those he leaves, and she who grieves, forever is the game. This book, Sing Before Breakfast, A Story of Gettysburg, is so poignant. And I think you have given a gift to all of us that would read it, because you share that war, no matter what time frame, this was in the 1800s, it doesn't make any difference. It's ugly, and yet the human drama of life experience that is woven through the experience itself, or experiences, I should say, are very profound. And in this book, Sing Before Breakfast, you bring it to life in a very, very special way. I really think it should be in every school and their history, because I feel that this is much of what has caused a lot of Americans to say, we just as soon not have war. We've had it on our own shores, and we know what it's like. We really don't want to participate.
Thank you for those words, Donna. I wish I had said them myself.
George Stein, you do have a website people can go to. And again, my compliments to your son, Doug, because he's just a masterful artist. Sing Before Breakfast. And it's spelled out, before is spelled out, not abbreviated. Sing Before Breakfast. You'll find more information about him. They're updating the website on and off always. So you can find out more about this marvelous man who has a gift for words and writing and expressing the soul of what many people experienced. And it's a gripper. It really is. Once you start it, you're not going to be able to put it down. George Stein, thank you again for being my guest today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Donna. It's been a pleasure.
It's a delight. And keep up your writing. You're a master.
Okay.
God bless. Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.
Here, you too. Bye-bye.
Donna Sebo here, and for those of you, again, that would like to submit material to me, just send it to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Lakewood, Washington, 98497. I really think that it is so important for us to realize that we all have our stories. We all have our memories. And those stories and memories can contribute volumes to the understanding of maybe what people did not witness or see. And I think there's magic in words, especially when you can express them, that when they're shared with other people, it's amazing, absolutely amazing. And you know, I can recall when I was in high school, I had a history teacher, and he was a former Marine. And this guy stood about 6 foot, 6 foot two, dark, wavy hair, square jaw. And I'll never forget this one day sitting in class. He sort of had the, what do you call, the 5 o'clock shadow. And he was sitting in class, and we kids were sort of bored. But someone had found out in the classroom that he was a Marine, that he had seen action in Korea. And we were bored. I'm telling you, we were bored out of our minds with the history books that were in front of us. And one of the kids dared to ask him if he would tell a story about his experience of being in Korea. And I'll never forget him sitting behind this narrow podium that he had the material on that he was lecturing to us about. And he put his right hand over his face and rubbed this 5 o'clock shadow. And you could sort of hear, because the classroom was just dead quiet, you could hear the scraping on of his fingers against his beard. It was that quiet. And then what he did, he looked at us. He said, "Do you really want to hear about what I went through?" The whole classroom said, "Yes," in one breath. And he began to tell us about some of his personal experiences. No one said a word. And what was important to us is that he was telling us his story, his experience. And I'll never forget how that in that classroom, he brought history to life in a way that none of us had really experienced before in school. There were always the textbooks, but no one had ever really lived the experiences that were in the books. And that is the power of your story. If you have members in your family that are very mature and you think they're old and you look at them and you go, what could they tell us? You never know. Sometimes they'll have stories to tell you that you would never imagine. And I would encourage you to do what a very dear friend of mine, her name is Mary and she lives in Alaska, what she did. Mary has a very strong feeling for family. And her grandmother was alive. And she said to me one day, "Donna, I know I've got to record my grandmother's stories." Well, her grandmother didn't think that her life was very exceptional. She thought her life was pretty simple. But it wasn't. There were a lot of complexities that had occurred in her grandmother's life. So Mary put the video machine in place and asked her grandmother, she said, "Would you please let me ask you questions and you tell me about your life? Because one day I'm going to have grandchildren and I'd like them to know about you. You may not be here." So her grandmother was a very petite lady with silver gray hair. She wore glasses and she sits on a couch and she looks so tiny. And she started sharing stories with Mary about how she lived, about the farm she was on, what they had to do when it came to taking care of the farm and food and how it was to preserve things. And she went on and on and on. And Mary went, "Wow, I never knew about her life." Now, her grandmother was very happy with her life. She really enjoyed living on the farm, taking care of the animals, taking in care of her children that came along. But there were aspects about lifestyle. Mary said, "I'll never see that." Well, it was about 10 years later, Mary ends up becoming a grandmother. She has done the film about her grandmother. She's got that on record. And then also she is doing the same thing with her mother. And her mother ended up becoming a professional in the medical arena. And so she lived a different lifestyle. And here we are today. Mary's lifestyle is very different, but she's been able to preserve a legacy that she is going to be able to share with her granddaughters. And her granddaughters are now about 5 years old. And she said in a few years, she figures that she'll just get it all out and let them know about the family history. This is something that when we can understand a little bit of our legacy, I think that's one of the reasons why genealogy has become so popular. Because many people are saying, I want to know a little bit more about my life and what's gone on before me. So, or behind me, you might say, so that I can be thoughtful about what I do and the legacy that I leave. People's stories are important, and that's one of the reasons why I love doing this show. It has allowed me in my 13 years of broadcasting to be able to share with you so much of what I have found out about other people, their lives, their environments. And I really think history is worth studying, no matter what your culture is. And you shouldn't be afraid to look at the not just the good, but the bad, and maybe even the ugly. Because in truth, we do stand on the shoulders that have gone before us, the people that have gone before us, but we need to be discerning about whose shoulder we want to stand on. Is it something that's positive? Is it something that's negative? Where do we want to go with it? That is a choice that we can make. So it's a delight for me to have had George on the show today because he shared so much of what he himself personally has experienced and has left a legacy that I think will touch the lives of many, many people. And don't forget, your life is important too. What kind of legacy would you like to leave? Have you ever thought about that? It's something worth giving time to. And by the way, if you ever have the thought that your life is inconsequential, I want you to be aware that it's got more value than you could ever imagine. In fact, it's priceless. So be mindful, be attentive, be aware that what you do, the words you express, the feelings you want to convey to others, the caring, being educated, being open to learning new things, all of this has an impact. Because you're going to be encountering other people along your road of experience in life, and how you treat them, how you communicate with them, makes all the difference in the world. I have to share this cute story with you. It's a guy by the name of Adam. He said, and I could really relate to this. He said, I just watched my dog chase his tail for 10 minutes, and I thought to myself, wow, dogs are so easily entertained. And then he had a second thought. He said, I realized something. I just watched my dog chase his tail for 10 minutes. Ah, yes. Nothing like being aware of certain things and then realizing, yes. You pointed something with one finger and there's four fingers or three fingers facing back, pointing back at you. So anyway, it was just a cute thing and I really wanted to share that with you today. By the way, we've got some wonderful guests coming up. Coming up, we're going to be talking with Laura Atchison, What Would a Wise Woman Do? And then Be a Genie, Maureen St. Germain is going to be teaching us tools of the mind, viral mythology, Marie Jones, The Money Nerve, Robert Wheeler, Hummingbirds Don't Fly in the Rain, Kimberly Klein, and UFOs, God's Chariots, Ted Peters. We have a diverse subject matter, and I invite you to join me whenever you like. Don't forget, all you have to do is Google Donna Sebo, go to the Donna Sebo Show page. On that page, there is a green flash player that's playing 24/7. On the right side of the page, you have a yellow banner. Tap on that. All of my shows fall down in that menu. Choose whichever one you like. The author's names are listed there. Tap the box on the right side of the author's name and then click play selection. And there you are. You can listen 24/7. It is a joy And I think it is something, it's just great. I'm able to, through the modern day technology, be able to share this program with you anytime you like. So that is a gift that is such a joy to be able to give to you. So pass along the information to your friends and to your family so that they can too enjoy the wonderful people and the programming that we have here on the Donna Sebo Show. And by the way, in September, we are starting up. I will be doing interviews with various individuals for a new show. It will be weekly, once a week. We haven't exactly determined the date, but I think it's going to be on Wednesday. It's Warriors for Peace. And we will be interviewing people from different cultures and environments that are truly warriors for peace. Jet lag. Have you ever experienced jet lag? Oh, it can hit you. And some people it affects more intensely than others. However, a type of jet lag sometimes can be experienced by people who work at night. And I can remember when I worked for a police department, our shifts changed every 3 months. We had 3 months of the day shift. We had 3 months of swing shift. We had 3 months of graveyard shift. And I was a zombie. I am not a person that works well on a graveyard shift at all. I just never could adapt to it. Well, we all have our own body clocks. And so many times when we're not attentive to that body clock, and there's some people that have a body clock that works well for working at night, they're not able to sleep when they should. Boy, can I relate to that one. Well, there are some glasses that have been developed. They're called retimers, and they help to reset one's body clock. And what it does, it uses the color green. That's right. There's a very soft green light that stimulates a part of the brain that regulates your sleep-wake cycle. Now, this was developed in Australia at the Flinders University, and you wear it for 50 minutes a day for 3 to 5 days in the morning for those who want to fall asleep and wake up earlier, and before bed for those who want to stay awake and sleep later. And it's not inexpensive. It's almost $300, but you can go to re-timer.com/US, and you'll find out information about that. So this is something that could be very, very useful for a person that is working irregular hours and wanting to bring everything back into harmony. Boy, this could really be a wonderful investment, and it could be very, very helpful to you. Also, there is a vision saver the size of an eyelash. It's a drainage device that they feel might help reduce eye pressure in glaucoma patients, protecting their vision and maybe enabling you to stop using prescription eye drops. It's called the Hydrus Stent. The Hydrus Stent provides an artificial channel for fluid to drain from the eye, normalizing the pressure. And they're developing larger stents for treating glaucoma. Well, they've tried the larger ones, let me put it that way, and it has too much of a risk of infection, bleeding, and eye damage. But this, they say, is the size of an eyelash, and that is very, very tiny. More and more research is being developed. It's amazing what they're coming up with so that we're going to be able to enjoy a healthier life and a better life. And I know so many people who, as they are getting older, when they're getting into their 80s, they find that they really have pretty good health, but certain parts of them are deteriorating. That's not unusual. That happens when you age. But we're reaching a time where we may be able to extend our physical body with adaptations that, well, sort of seemed like sci-fi, but not really. Donna Sebo, we are going to be with you again, and I invite you to join me at my broadcasting table. Remember always that you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is a wonderful day. You are alive. You have the opportunity to experience the best and to embark on another adventure of this experience we call life. Won't you savor it and be mindful of it and realize that what you do does count? Make the best of it. And don't forget, employ a smile for those people that you meet. You never know when it will make a difference in their day. This is Donna. Bye for now. God bless.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.